Welcome back. Margot Jefferson grew up in a world where black people appeared to have power long before she was the theater critic at the New York Times and the winner of a Pulitzer Prize. She came of age in a part of Chicago where her family belonged to a black upper crust, one where privilege and class defined expectations for behavior and what was required for success. But by the time Jefferson discovered radicalism during the Civil Rights era, she was confronting questions about what it truly means for black people to have power in America, questions that are every bit as relevant today, now that the phrase Black Lives Matter dominates so many conversations about race, justice, and opportunity. Margot Jefferson joins us from NPR Studios in New York. She is the author of Negroland, a memoir. She's a former theater critic for the New York Times, where she won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1995. Margot Jefferson, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You grew up in a social universe in Chicago that you describe as Negroland. Why did you use this phrase to describe the place you came from?
Well, I used it partly to fix on a historical time. Negro was the proper, the honored word for a first half, certainly, of the 20th century. So I wanted to delineate that historical space, but also combining it with land, I wanted to give a sense that this world was a very particular social and mythological as well as geographical space. It's a land that borders on the larger lands or worlds of black life, and a land that also bordered on, made incursions into the white world.
What was your relationship with white Chicago as a child? Your family moved to the Kenwood neighborhood in Hyde Park when you were still a child. This was a part of...
No, actually,
you were in high school.
We did not move. We moved into what had been an all-white neighborhood that was under assault, as the whites there would have seen it, by black people. It was we moved there when I was about three. It was Park Manor. And all I can remember was an almost entirely black neighborhood. So clearly, those urban processes of, white people clearing out as any kind of black people move in were on the move. So I grew up in a world that was both segregated, meaning as far as the eye could see in my day-to-day life, it was all black, and yet integrated in that I began to go to mostly, not all, but largely white school when I entered kindergarten in 1952, 2 years before we desegregated public schools, yes.
When you say that privilege was part of that universe where you grew up, how do you define privilege? You write that it's a far cry from entitlement.
Yes, and what I mean is that the privileges, that's economic, that's social, that's educational, it's access to advantages, as we used to call them. It's also certain assumptions about manners, entertainment, how you live your life, ambition, what's available to you. But for all black people, privilege is provisional. It's always rung round, and certainly when my parents, their parents, and I grew up, it was still rung round with all kinds of prohibitions, limitations on, who was allowed where, on which professions, would allow the most minimal integration on where you could go to eat or shop. There's a long systematic history of keeping back, confining privileges, which let's basically call them bourgeois and above privileges, which white people wanted to claim entirely for themselves and felt they had every right to. The assumption for black people was you had to prove you could do it in the face of any kind of discrimination, and you didn't really have a right to it. Entitlement means, let's say, white entitlement is the sense that any white person can claim or choose to claim that I am superior by birth, my culture, my being. I am entitled to all that history and society provide, and I am entitled to the best to be thought very well of by everyone. This was not this was not our destiny. There's an interesting piece in the Times this morning, an op-ed by Gordon Davis.
I read that op-ed by Gordon Davis in which he talked
about... Gordon and I grew up, in fact, together.
In which he talked about what happened to his grandfather. Please tell that story.
Well, it's very interesting because here are the protests at Princeton about the enshrinement of
Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, his name, you know, blazoned across schools of public policy, dormitories. And, of course, that means the better parts of his history are what are talked about. This piece was really about his racist legacy, which
was... How he segregated the federal government.
Exactly. This was systematic. First, as the president of Princeton, he made sure it was a proclamation and a declaration that no black students would have been all men then would it were to be allowed. So we were not fit for certain kinds of education. Then when he became president, he systematically segregated the federal civil service.
Gordon Davis's grandfather went from a man who was making what in those days was a princely sum of more than $1,400 a year. He was demoted to the point where he was a messenger who was making $700 a year. And it broke him, essentially.
It broke him. It broke his family. And you know, these kinds of demotions, yes, of course. Yes, of course, the result is you lose money. But you lose pride. That is so much a part of racism, to destroy people's pride, to deprive them of a sense that they can fulfill, express themselves, be respected. And that's what happened to him, too.
The difference between
those are the nuances and the brutalities of individual black lives, that individual psyches, black psyches matter too.
We're talking with Margo Jefferson. She is the author of Negroland, a memoir. She's a former theater critic for the New York Times, where she won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1995. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-433-8850. To what degree do you feel privilege shapes the lives of people who live in the upper echelons of black America? And to what extent do you believe that those people also do not have what Margo Jefferson describes as entitlement? 800-433-8850. You can send email to coach@wamu.org. You write that the politics of responsibility is something that goes back to slavery, the politics of black people knowing their place. Where did that show up in your part of Chicago?
Well, it was complicated and in a way contradictory. The drive to achieve and excel, to in fact move above the designated place of black people and to be, let us say, a lawyer or a doctor or a businessman, to be a successful teacher, accountant, to win your children a good education. All of that was there, and yet it was all that was our responsibility to show, to prove that we could achieve these things, which meant in some way we were trying to prove respectability politics. You said responsibility, but it's very much respectability, that we were as worthy, as decent as white people. You accumulate, you work for these, you do good deeds in the culture. But at the same time, we knew that every moment that we needed to, and this is outside of the, thank God, progress of the civil rights movement, we knew that we needed to behave well, to be mannerly, and that ranged from not being too, loud in a department store or a restaurant to making sure, for example, when you were in school or in an integrated white setting, that you were dignified, but you were not arrogant.
That notion of respectability politics ran into what I call the buzzsaw of black power. Talk about how those Indeed. Notions were upturned for you when you ran into black power, and talk about when and where you discovered radicalism.
Well, yeah, let's all say we were prepared and set forth into the world by the civil rights movement. And yes. when black power came along, those divisions began to multiply. But, black power was a major challenge to every notion of respectability and propriety and comportment, if you will. In those amazing civil rights demonstrations, one of the fascinating things is people are being beaten, hosed, etc., and they are dressed.
They're wearing suits and ties.
Exactly. And the perfect hats, you know, the Martin Luther King hat. And, you know, this is a perfect symbol of, you know, do not think for a moment that we are losing our dignity and respectability. You are the enemy. You are the aggressor. Among other things, black power made black people, particularly black men, but, you know, that's an important part of the story, into the aggressors. We will claim rights. We will indeed be arrogant in public. We will call out your crimes, your sins, in the most blatant language. You know, we will take physical. We will be physical aggressors. You know, we will arm ourselves. And culturally, you know, because I've spent my life as a book and a theater and an arts critic. Culturally, we also will refuse to accept the notion that what we think of as black culture, whether it's blues or jazz or all the possibilities of black vernacular, black English, we will absolutely reject the notion that any of that is primitive, inferior, second-class material for artists.
It was indeed, as someone who was a part of it, an in-your-face kind of movement.
So totally in-your-face. And, you know, you saw it physically. The afros. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know, the black leather jackets, the first, you know, infusion of African-style clothing. It was everywhere.
Go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
It certainly did infuse an element of pride in the appearance of black folks because, as I recall, the Black Power movement is what essentially ushered in the Black is Beautiful movement.
Oh, not a question. Not a question. So it also overturned, you know, not just decades or generations, but a couple of centuries, or it at least challenged. No movement fully overturns the bad work of centuries, but it challenged and upended and created, you know, vehemently this space for all of the standards of beauty and appropriateness that we had been, told were perfect, basically Anglo-Saxon Nordic standards. You know, the thin little nose, the little mouth, if possible, very straight. Dead straight, as we used to say, blonde hair. All of these things were so the color, the skin color coding, the feature, the obsession about sub-Saharan features. Oh my God! All of this got, you know, really churned up, thrown out.
What were your
many things that we had considered secretive and shameful. This is really important, you know. From about our looks, about how we carried ourselves, about our culture, our street culture. Secret and shameful no more, you know, honorable, exhilarating sources of creativity and aesthetics. The black aesthetic was a huge part of the movement.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Margot Jefferson. She is the author of Negroland, a memoir. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-433-8850, if you already have. Hang on. We'll get to your call when we come back. You can also send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi.
quiet, Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
We're talking with Margot Jefferson. She is the author of Negroland, a memoir. Margot Jefferson is a former theater critic for the New York Times, where she won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. I'd like to go directly to the phones. Here is Hamza in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hamza, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Margot and Kojo. Thanks for having me on. I just finished reading Negroland just this past weekend. I really enjoyed it. It's a good book. And I just had a question. As I was reading through it, I noticed that towards the middle and end of the book, it didn't seem like you spoke as much about your father. And he was very prominent in the earlier parts of the book. So I was just trying to hear from you, like, was, you know, that on purpose or just didn't have as much to say towards the end, I guess?
His
role in your life.
It was on purpose because I still, from start to finish, from the early to the later parts of the book, I'm still talking about really the first, you know, third, in a sense, of my life. And my mother was day to day. My mother was a stay-at-home mother. Day to day, she was, you know, absolutely, talk about immersion. She was immersed in our lives, and we were immersed in hers. My father's role in our lives, in the whole structure and look and drive of our lives was huge. But this is the 50s. My father was at his office or at the hospital for many, many, many hours. I simply didn't know him as well or see him as much. So, you know, to be fair to those particular years and the strongest influences on me as a young black girl, a young Negro girl becoming a young black woman, my mother for this book was the dominant force.
Hamza, thank you very much for your call. We move on to James in Washington, D.C. James, your turn.
Thank you very much for this honor, Kojo. And good afternoon, Mrs. Jefferson.
Miss Jefferson.
Miss Jefferson, will you be having book signings on your schedule of your masterpiece, Negroland, in the Washington metropolitan area anytime in the future? And also, will there be a sequel to Negroland?
Well, number one, I'm sorry to say that I was just at Politics and Prose last weekend, so I don't know when Washington will emerge again. I don't know if there will be a sequel. I've thought about it. I've talked to friends, other writers about it, but I'm still thinking and feeling my way into what the next book will be. It would be interesting, you know, to take up other parts of my life, but we'll see. There are a lot of other things to write about too.
Thank you very much for your call, James. At what point, Margot Jefferson, did you start suffering from depression? You write that there was a time when, in your life, when you started regularly practicing sticking your head in the oven.
Well, we all have our strange rituals, do we not? I think I became. In fact, I began to become aware of it in college, and I became quite aware of it as a recurring pattern, almost drive, in the 70s, early 70s, when I actually became a young working woman. My first job actually was at Newsweek as a book critic, and in those years I began to become very aware of it. It's also interesting that, you know, the women's movement was emerging, and I was and am a very strong feminist. You know, it was a time, gay rights then came along. It was a time, civil rights, black power, women's movement, gay rights, of huge social and individual and personal change. And I do think, as extraordinary, as blessed as I was by, you know, being in the middle, or at least on the periphery, available to all of this, a lot of intense social change stirs up in every individual a lot of internal change. You know, you are remapping yourself, you know, and often different parts of your personality and different the price you've paid to become what you are. These things really start emerging, and they can really throw you, you know, off balance and into other spaces you didn't think existed inside you. Ultimately, this is a good thing, but it can be very scary.
I was fascinated by some of the people you mentioned who you were looking to. Florence Kennedy, the famous lawyer, on one hand.
Yes.
Intozaki Shange, who wrote the book for colored women who have considered suicide
for
when the rainbow.
Colored
girls. When you say that the responsible Negro women and indomitable Black women were not to be depressed, were not to suffer from nervous breakdowns because they were made to feel they had a legacy. In your particular case, what was that legacy?
That legacy was, number one, to repudiate in every way every long-held stereotype, long-held meaning for centuries, about Black women. If you go back to the 19th, the 18th century, the working narrative is Black women are loose, you know, they're wanton, they're slovenly, they're not, like all Black people, they're not intelligent. Because of the ideologies of womanhood, this turned into they are, you know, incapable of being mothers, of being wives, of being partners. You know, they are loose and inferior morally, ethically. Now, a lot of this plays into, you know, the doctrine of proper female womanhood. But, you know, these are ugly stereotypes. And we were supposed to, by our achievement, our intelligence, our propriety, social and in the 50s, sexual, pre the sexual revolution, we were supposed to counter that and to embody the opposition. Now, the other part of that legacy is, you know, the Black women who were fighting this war were supposed to be indomitable. And this does not just apply to women, it applies to men. Often you will hear Black people say, you know, we're too strong to be depressed or to be suicidal. Yep. And if we were, that would be a sign that racism had gotten to us. So it is, again, shameful to admit or to experience those things, because that means you're letting the man, you know, get to you.
You know, we mentioned Flo Kennedy. One of the reasons for that is we talked with her friend Gloria Steinem on this broadcast a few weeks ago. And
I heard that.
Flo Kennedy, of course, overturned every single stereotype you could conceivably think of when you looked at her.
Everyone.
She used to say to Black women that too many of them saw feminism as a white women's thing. To what degree do you feel that may have changed?
Well, it is certainly changing. Because, you know, there have been so many, no, there is an active Black women's movement, Black feminist movement, on all fronts, everything from, you know, politics and literature to, you know, healthcare. And so we have created our own space as feminists. And when you can do that, you create your space, you find your power, you connect it to your history, which is not the history of white women, though it may, you know, in very, very rare cases overlap. Once you've done that, you are able to make alliances, to reach out. You know, it's so interesting to me that among the founders of Black Lives Matter, you know, women are crucial. Yeah. So there we are.
They're not just crucial, they're very consciously crucial.
And visible, and very visible.
Yep.
And very aware that they are new as visible leaders. You know, women were all over the civil rights movement and important in Black power, but we were supposed to stand back and in that way be decorous and not advertise our contributions. This is a huge difference.
Indeed, that was going to be my final question to you. What do you hear when you hear the phrase, Black Lives Matter?
I hear that every kind of black life, every nuance, every broad aspect of it matters, and that we must all of these individual black lives that are forming, you know, groups to fight and lobby for ourselves, we must recognize our own variety and find ways to talk to each other and to collaborate and work together.
Margo Jefferson is the author of Negroland, a memoir, former theater critic for the New York Times, where she won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. Margo Jefferson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.